In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about philosophy. Now, I don't know what sort of associations people will have with philosophy, but my guess is that most people will say, as far as they are concerned and their daily life is concerned, philosophy just doesn't enter into it. Philosophy is something that's done by college professors, for example, who think rarefied thoughts, and it's just not something for everyone. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Lou Marinoff, makes a different kind of argument. He says, in fact, philosophy can be something for everyone, and that it indeed has practical applications. Learning to think and looking at the ways that different people over time have thought about important things can be very helpful to people in their daily lives, so he would argue. In fact, in his book, The Big Questions, How Philosophy Can Change Your Life, he writes this. He says, you can't always change your circumstances, but you can always change the way in which you interpret them. The way in which you interpret your circumstances is none other than your philosophy of life. He goes on to write, my question to you is this, does your philosophy of life work for you, against you, or not at all? If it already works for you, good, but you can make it work even better. If it works against you, not so good, but you can get it to start working for you. And if it doesn't work at all, that's a waste, but you can get it up and running. The book, The Big Questions, is out now. And if you're interested, you can head down to the bookstore and take a look at it. Our guest, Lou Marinoff, is professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. He is also the founding president of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association, and has been a philosophical counselor and consultant for the last 12 years. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask of people is they just try to be brief so we can keep the program moving, but anyone is welcome to call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Professor Marinoff, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
You're very welcome.
We are very intrigued, and I think even before we knew about the book, The Big Questions, we were intrigued by this idea of practical philosophy or applied philosophy, whatever you want to call it, and the idea that someone might actually hang out a shingle with a background in philosophy,
yes,
and would have a kind of a counseling practice, very like, not unrelated to psychotherapy or psychology, where people would have problems they're trying to deal with in their life, and are interested in some assistance, and maybe in addition to or instead of going with a psychological counselor, they might go to a philosophical counselor. And this idea fascinated us. Let's talk about that and what you do and how it is like or differs from what psychologists do.
Sure, and one could also throw psychiatry into the mix, too, if you want to complicate everybody's lives.
Sure.
We have many different levels or layers of existence. We're not simple beings, we're complex beings. And if there's something biologically wrong with us, then it's the medical profession that normally takes care of this. If we have emotional disturbances of a certain kind, then very often it's psychologists of one kind or another who minister to them. But if we have problems with our principles, if we have moral dilemmas, questions of meaning, value, and purpose, which increasingly we have in America, because we're an extraordinarily materialistic and hedonistic culture, and we've made that work to a point, but materialism and hedonism do not address the fundamental problems of human value in life, and this philosophy does. So the first task for your listeners and for people in general is to figure out what kind of problem they have and then get the most appropriate help for it that they can.
Mm. I suppose that there are a lot of people who really don't know or aren't quite sure what philosophy is. And what philosophers do, they maybe have the sort of vague notion that they, you know, they think profound thoughts and they think about existence and meaning You know, do we know that we are here, and what's reality, and, you know, things like that. I'm being just a little bit flippant, but I think that's the impression a lot of people have.
Well, they have that impression for a very good reason, and what you said off the top of the program is also true, that a lot of people in America, certainly when they hear the word philosophy, they run the other way. First of all, it has too many syllables, and secondly, they have associations. Perhaps they went to college and were forced to take a philosophy course, and they found it irrelevant. They may have had a great professor, in which case it'll be with them all their lives, but too many people in this country have succumbed to what philosophers have done to philosophy, which is to make it irrelevant and to make themselves inaccessible. And people who are only publishing papers that are incomprehensible to the masses and who are only engaged in private dialogues amongst themselves, I call theoretical philosophers. And we need the theory. We have 2,500 years worth of theory. We have to keep adding to it. But we have lost the practical side of it. In the ancient world, philosophy was a guide to the art of living. Aristotle had a word for it. It's called phronesis. It meant practical wisdom. And what is the use of all this theory if nothing can be put into practice? A professional philosopher may know 24 theories of ethics, but needs to be able to, if he can't help...
Oh, I believe we just lost the guest.
Hello?
Oh, you're back. Oh,
yeah, we're back. A person who, you know, a theoretical philosopher who knows 24 theories of ethics, but who can't help one person do the right thing, is obviously lacking on the practical side. So my colleagues and I are putting philosophy back into practice where it can be useful for ordinary people.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Lou Marinoff, if you're interested in reading up on this issue, you can look for his book, The Big Questions, How Philosophy Can Change Your Life. He is also the author of a previous book that got a lot of attention titled Plato Not Prozac, which is now available in paperback. He is professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. He is also the founding president of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association. Can you give an example so we can give people something a little bit concrete about how it is, say, take a particular problem and how you as a philosophical counselor might help that person think about that problem?
Well, sure, and you know that both my books are full of cases. I mean, there are dozens
quite
of case
so.
Studies
quite
that
so.
Illustrate how philosophy east, west, and in between can help people. There's a case for one of the more recent cases I've had is of a woman who was very, very successful professionally, had a great education, had entered the corporate world, was making good money, had prospects for a phenomenal career, but was fundamentally very unhappy because she had been obliged, in a sense, or partly coerced, to neglect the personal side and the familial side of her development. So her philosophy of life really had been operating on the premise that she should behave like a man and go after the big career, and that would be fulfilling for her. But then when she hit about the age of 30, she began to realize that she really also wanted to have, you know, children and a family life, and so had to make certain choices. Now, there was nothing psychologically wrong with her. She had to prioritize her thinking and perhaps live a part of her that had not been lived yet in order to be fulfilled as a human being. And there are a whole host of philosophers who can help to address these kinds of issues. In her case, we looked at Aristotle, who talked about fulfillment in a certain way coming from within, not from external things, but from following one's heart as well as one's mind, and also the Tao in leading a balanced life.
You know, I suspect also that if we went out and started asking people if they had a philosophy of life, a lot of people would say, well, no, I don't really think so, or I'm not sure. And then if we started to engage them in dialogue, if we started asking them, started giving them various hypothetical situations and said, well, what would you do in that situation? I think that we'd find that, in fact, people do indeed have philosophies of life that they don't recognize that that's what they are, but they do have them. That is, at least they have principles that they use to guide them in their daily life. And I'm interested in this issue of whether you assist people in developing a philosophy of life, or whether you point out to them that in fact they already have one, that they just don't know it. And right. what exactly constitutes a philosophy of life?
Right. Well, I think you already said it, David. It's the principles by which we live. If everything's going well for us, and at times, you know, everybody experiences sort of being on a roll or things are working out well, then they probably don't need to articulate the principles by which we live. But normally, what happens is when we encounter a difficult situation, when there's an obstacle, an obstruction, a conflict, you know, when we run into people who try to impede us or oppose us, and so forth, or when circumstances themselves, owing to illness or injury or bad luck, put us into a difficult situation, and we're not feeling good about ourselves, then and only then are our characters tested. Then we have to find the principles by which we live and put them into practice in order to see ourselves through difficult times. That's when philosophy is actually most helpful.
Yeah. Something that I really struck me in looking in the book is I think that there are a lot of people who would like to believe that one set of principles, one set of rules should be able to take you through anything. And that either they believe that things think the world should be that way or the world is that way.
Yeah, well, this unfortunately often causes more problems than it cures. When I hear someone who has the truth, I usually run the other way. I don't mean that everything is relative, by the way. 1 + 1 = 2. I'm not an anti-realist. But life is very complex now. Our civilization, our culture have reached a state of complexity that is simply unprecedented. And we need all the resources we can get. One day, maybe Stoicism is really going to help you get through the day. Another day, you see, it might be Confucianism, and you never know. So it's the more philosophies you have, the more ideas you understand, the more thinkers that you are aware of who've worked through similar situations, the more tools you have in your toolkit. You know, what kind of a carpenter runs around with just a hammer or just a screwdriver? You need an assortment of tools to do a given job. And the same is true of ideas.
Yeah, I think that's what it made me think about, the idea that that sometimes people are very critical of the idea of situational ethics. You know, the idea that you're presented with a particular problem and you might solve it in one way. You're presented with a different problem, you can't approach it in the same way. And you seem to be making this strong point, and I think it's important for people to get that this is not complete relativism. This is not anything is right, anybody's solution is right. What this says is that, well, there may be a given number of solutions that in a given number of problems that could be correct, but that doesn't mean anything goes anytime, anyway.
Not at all. And I'm not a moral relativist, and it's very important to make this distinction. Moral relativism asserts basically that whatever anybody believes is right for them, and who are we to judge? But in fact, that can lead to the justification of absolutely heinous things, from terrorism on, you know, onward. But an ethical, meta-ethical relativist, or a situational ethicist, as you want to describe it, is someone who says, look, in different situations, different ethical systems may work better or worse, so my real job as a meta-ethicist is to find the best ethical system in this situation. And therefore, one needs to be conversant with a number of them, once again, in order to find the one that works best in a given situation.
Some people I know would argue that that morals come from religious values. Other people, I suppose, would also make a counter argument that says it's actually possible to be a moral secular humanist and not be a religious person and have some justification for doing certain things, certain ways. Where do morals come from?
Well, this is a really big question, and I think that traditionally they come from organized religions. You know, the real great goal of secular philosophy has always been to convince people, in a moral domain anyway, to convince people that they should do good for its own sake, or do right for its own sake, or be just for its own sake. And many philosophers, such as Kant in more modern times, and, you know, Socrates pursued this question, Plato did in his Republic, so did Lao Tzu, so did Buddha, for that matter. But it's been very difficult for secular philosophers to come up with a really convincing argument, you know, that would make most people do good in a given situation. Even defining good has been very difficult. Whereas providential religions have succeeded because they can make almost any kind of promise about the next world without having to prove their claims. They're basically a faith-based enterprise, and people will always, you know, lean toward something that affords them hope, particularly if they're in a desperate situation or if they're afraid or if they're anxious or if they don't understand life. So religions have all the answers. Philosophy has all the questions. Religions have been successful because they're faith-based. Philosophy has to be successful as a doubt-based enterprise, and many people are basically unwilling to live with doubt.
Why is it that it seems that so many people think that we have such a crisis going in this area? And is it because the big questions are bigger and more difficult, or have we somehow failed in teaching people how to think about these things?
Both. Both. Our lives are much more complicated than they used to be. We have real identities. We have virtual identities. We have to multitask. We interface with all kinds of technologies. If you compare our lives to the lives of our grandparents or great-grandparents, they are extraordinarily complex, longer lived as well, with all kinds of things going on. Now, this is sometimes very confusing for people, and technology is always ahead of morality. You know, all the things we can do, from neonatal tissue implants to harvesting of organs to, you know, genetically modifying foodstuffs, there's so many things we can do technologically. There's always a gap between what we can do and what we should do. The moral question always looms. Just because we can do something, should we do it? So the complexity of life forces people sooner or later to ask these deeper philosophical questions on the one hand. On the other hand, our educational system is in a catastrophic failure. We're in free fall here. We're producing people who have no conception of who or where they are or how they got here in terms of our own history and our own values in this society. And it's really a problem. We're replacing the written tradition by a visual one. Any image can follow any other image. There doesn't have to be any internal logic to it. One appeals to sensationalism and emotion, and we basically have preempted the processing of thoughts and ideas in our K-12 system. It's really a disaster, I must tell you. And I'm an optimist.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Lou Marinoff. He is professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. He is also the founding president of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association and has been a philosophical counselor and consultant for the last 12 years. He is the author of two books that explore this approach to philosophy. The most recent is titled The Big Questions, How Philosophy Can Change Your Life. It's published by Bloomsbury. And then before that, a book that got a lot of attention is now available in paperback if you'd like to look at it, titled Plato, Not Prozac. If you have questions, big ones particularly, if you'd like to call in here, talk with our guest, you're welcome to do that. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. If you'd be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, use that number, 800-222-9455. We have someone here to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about mind and body as in relation to philosophy. For example, you know, some people might call Buddhism a religion or they might call it a philosophy. You have yoga that, obviously is related to philosophy or religion, but it involves a physical practice or discipline. You have Sufism and you have people who were very highly involved in Sufism that also studied philosophy, like Ibn Arabi.
Yes.
And then also just this question of disciplinary divisions, you know, whether one goes to a philosophical counselor or a psychologist, whether one goes to a minister or studies philosophy or wants to change the world through politics and how one sees one's relationship as an individual to the rest of the world. I guess I'm wondering if some of these kind of divisions, disciplinary divisions that we have previously had might be being called into question. And then, for example, in Buddhism, people talk about the mind,
mm-hmm.
and you're sort of also saying you have to change your point of view in order to, you know, quote, be able to deal with the world. Maybe you can't deal with the world because it's the way you see the world. Maybe I'm wrong in paraphrasing it that way. But how do you see the relationship between the state of mind that one has and the world? You know,
well, it's very, very important. These are two great questions. So let me deal with mind-body first, okay? And this may or may not be a false distinction, but we have yet to see a reduction of thoughts to biochemistry, okay? Although there are philosophers who now believe that everything is reducible to biology, as well as other people who believe this, no one has ever demonstrated or proved that a thought, in fact, can be represented to some electrochemical brain state. So, I mean, we're free to believe that the mind has properties that the body doesn't, okay? I personally do, as Plato did and many others do. As far as Buddha is concerned, his philosophy, for me, it is a philosophy, although, as you rightly say, it can be made and has been made into a religion. But for me, if you take Buddha's principles and apply them, it's almost scientific because you can test the efficacy of the principles. To a very large extent, what happens to you in life is partly a creation of your own thought forms. And you can conduct the experiment. If you think ill of people, this has results in the world. People will think ill of you in return. If you think well of people, this has results in the world. People will think well of you in turn. This is called karma, not as fate. In traditional Indian philosophy, it's a question of fate and how you're born. But Buddha reformed that and taught a doctrine of karma that is basically according to will. So what you will for yourself will, in time, come to pass. So we're all holding Aladdin's lamp from this perspective. So we have to be very careful what we wish for because ultimately we are going to get it. Okay? So on the mind-body problem, I think it's interactive. Basically, how you think about your own health and your own diet and your own lifestyle obviously affects your body, doesn't it? If you go out and eat a lot of junk food, then this is a decision you've made or a habit you've fallen into. And it's going to affect your physical health in a poor way. If you make an effort to think and eat more carefully and more healthfully, your body, of course, is going to be more healthy. Similarly, if you're physically ill, for any reason, it's more difficult to use use your higher cognitive functions. So I think there's an intimate relation between the two, and only a wholesome philosophy of life will make the most of it. As far as disciplinary divisions are concerned, we're going back to what David and I were talking about earlier in the program, and that is that if there's something physically wrong, you have to get a medical evaluation to find out what it is. Hopefully, there will be a diagnosis and a prescription for a treatment if there's a physical problem. Similarly, as people grow, they encounter psychological difficulties as part of maturation. They have to get to know themselves psychologically, and cognitive psychologists, among others, offer very valuable insights. But eventually, you reach a point where you know yourself physically pretty well, you know yourself psychologically pretty well. Beyond that lies the domain of philosophy, and people who want to mature more fully as beings in the world should definitely then get to know themselves philosophically.
Oh, can I ask another question?
Sure.
So you've underlined then the interaction between the world and the mind. For example, if someone is subjected to sexual abuse, this might cause damage. It may cause them to damage other people in that way, or they might come to some consciousness where they do not repeat the same patterns.
Precisely, because they're aware of the harm that was done to them, and they want it to stop in the world, and it also alleviates their own suffering this way. People who, for example, were abused as children, whether sexually or whether physically, if they themselves become parents, I know some who are absolutely beautiful parents and treat their children with great love and respect and also discipline, but don't abuse them. Why? Because they themselves were abused, and they know how bad it is to do that. On the other hand, you do have abusive patterns and cycles that repeat through the generations, but all of this implies that there's a choice in the matter, then we're not simply conditioned rats or pigeons, in mazes, that we do as human beings exercise a great deal more latitude in our affairs if we will allow ourselves, in fact, to make use of the power of our minds.
Do you have anything called engaged philosophy that might be similar to engaged Buddhism that wouldn't just focus on the individual mind, but the interaction of the mind and the world?
Well, I mean, I see this as philosophy in its essence, realizing that we are all interconnected and understanding that what we think and what we say and what we do have repercussions. It's like dropping a stone into a pond. There's a ripple effect. And understanding this is, in fact, the ultimate engagement.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. In the book, The Big Question, is one of the things that you discuss and encourage people to think about as they think about philosophical counseling and its role in the whole panoply of counseling that's out there available, is encouraging people to think about the distinction between disease and dis-ease, that is with a hyphen in there, and the idea that, in fact, there are things that are the result of physical disease processes, and then there are other things that are different and amenable to a different kind of treatment. And I guess I'm wondering what of the kind of emotional, psychological distress that people experience, how much of it you think is not disease, that it is not biochemical, it's not something that you can treat with medication, and how much of the pain, kind of pain that the suffering that people experience, is more a matter of dis-ease?
Yes, this is of course the big question of the big questions, and making that distinction is really worthwhile. I would encourage your listeners to think about this very carefully next time they're in a difficult situation. Suppose you have the boss from hell, or suppose you've just lost your job, or you're in the throes of a career change, for example, as many people are. So what are you going to do? You can go to a doctor or a psychiatrist, and you will probably legitimately have symptoms of anxiety or upset or maybe even mild depression, and you can get a prescription probably for Paxil or Prozac or some drug, and you may feel better on the day. This, of course, is not going to address the root problem, which is the meaning of your work life. What is your career coming to? What do you do now to make yourself a fulfilled human being? That answer is not going to come out of a prescription. It's not going to come out of a pill bottle, not yet, anyway. You could also go to a psychologist, and you could have an exegesis of your entire past. You could find out, all the things that happened to you when you're little, which may or may not be at all relevant to what's happening today. If you happen to be fired in your job, it doesn't mean that this was a direct deterministic cause of something that you experienced when you're 3 years old. But you can find out if it is. You can try and see if the causal connection works for you or not. Philosophers generally who counsel work from the present toward the future. We're not that interested in your past. We don't think it's relevant. We, again, suppose a degree of free will. We suppose that habits indeed can be changed, and habitual ways of thought and living can also be changed and replaced by better lived experience. So we're interested in the present, and we're interested in moving forward to the future. What the previous caller asked is also, in a sense, applicable to this. If you think about Stoicism, Epictetus very famously said that we are not upset by things or by circumstances, rather by the views we take of them. So if you've just lost your job, you could choose to be upset because of the thing you've lost, or in fact, you could choose to be encouraged because of the possibility of the thing you're about to gain.
We have somebody who's listening. They're in their car. They're on the road, so they're on a mobile phone, and we'll talk with them on our line number four right here. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yes.
I'm very much enjoying your program this morning, and was thinking about the fact that as we move to a global economy, we move to more international forms of government, whether there is any movement toward the development of a new global religion.
Well, what do you think, Professor Barana?
That's a great question. I can help a little bit here and tell you that I am involved with the Global Village, with the World Economic Forum, and so I've met and discussed this kind of issue with many heads of state and business and cultural leaders as well. And there is a hope that we can find a framework for integrating the Global Village in a way that will not be oppressive or intrusive, that will be tolerant of differences, you know, religious,
right,
cultural, and philosophical ones, but that will unite humanity in a much more inclusive vision of what we can be if we worked better together. And this would not, I do not think, fix on a particular religion. It would embrace all religions as potentially good for people in terms of the moral guidance and hope that they afford, but it would certainly not want to see any one religion in ascendancy over all others. That would lead back to a lot of problems that we've already seen.
We've seen a few of those, yeah. Now, but is that a new philosophical construct, or is it like many of the interfaith activities where it's just kind to sort of patch together an amalgam of current religious / philosophical constructs?
Well, you're asking a philosopher, so naturally from a religious standpoint, I'm bound to be a bit of a heretic here and tell you that, you know, I think that the religious people, in fact, are capable of setting a great example insofar as they're willing to work together. Interfaith dialogue is one of the most important weapons, if you like, in quotes, against fanaticism, against religious intolerance, and that, and, you know, every religion has great esoteric teachings which liberate the human spirit, and every religion, when it becomes corrupted, if it is, you know, corrupted, can lead to just simply horrible things for all involved. So interfaith dialogue is good because it shows us that religious leaders are willing to work together and set a good example, bringing harmony out of diversity of belief. But as a philosopher, I'm bound to suppose that we need a secular set of principles by which to govern the global village. We cannot allow religion to dictate global politics to us. We have to, as we separated church from state in this country, and I think quite successfully, people are free to worship in their own way, but still are obliged to abide by the Constitution. I think we need a parallel process to make the global village a more livable place.
Well, I shall continue to watch with interest. Thanks for your comment.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And again, others with questions, comments are certainly welcome to call 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I was looking at the website of the organization that you founded and that you're involved with, the American Philosophical Practitioners Association, and you have a motto, a Latin motto. And I won't claim to have been able to translate it because it offers a translation here. I did take a little Latin, but I don't think I remember much of anything from it. The motto "Nemo Veritatem Regit" translates as "Nobody Rules Truth," and it seems to me that one of the reasons we have an awful lot of conflict in the world today, and perhaps it's always been the case, is that we have people who feel they do.
Precisely.
What does one do about that?
Well, this is a great question. I want to take almost a humoresque view of it for the first. I mean, I can be very serious if you want me to. You know this, David. But in the first place, you know, we're often asked, are we a cult? Are we a religion? Are we, you know, like the Moonies?
Yeah.
Are we like something
right.
else? And I tell people, look, the way to tell the difference between a philosophical group and a cult is very simple. Cultists all, if they walk into an ice cream parlor, they all have the same flavor, right? If the leader orders vanilla, everybody orders vanilla. You know, it's a cult, right? You put a bunch of philosophers in an ice cream parlor, they're going to order each a different flavor. Moreover, they're going to probably argue with each other about which flavor they should be having. But at the end of the day, they're all going to do something different. And if you put a bunch of philosophers in the same room, we will not agree about anything, actually, at the end of the day. Probably we'll be willing to debate any point amongst ourselves. But by the same token, we're united by a desire to do good in the world, to have people question their beliefs and get along better themselves and collectively. So the idea that nobody rules truth is also the idea that we should not desist from seeking truth. We should be courageous enough to confront truth about ourselves and about others, and not be stifled by political correctness here or you know, totalitarianism abroad. We should live as freely as possible and use that freedom to find out important things. But that no human being is above truth to the point where they can rule it for others. Mm. So you've understood the motto perfectly.
We have another caller here. They are in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I believe the author of the book, The Big Questions, was Robert C. Solomon. So you've taken his title, I understand.
Well, there is no copyright on title, I'm pleased to tell you. I'm as a staunch defender of intellectual property rights as anybody else. But in fact, legally and ethically, one can, you could write a play and call it Hamlet if you wanted to. Of course, some people would claim that, you know, that Shakespeare's Hamlet really is, you know, the great one. But you're free to call anything, including your children, by the way. I guess there are quite a few people with the same name out there, too, aren't there?
Good point. Well, I'm not really choosing you on this. I'd like you to address, since we're talking about Plato and Aristotle here, to take up Demosthenes, the cynic, who I think's relevancy today is probably more important than the others, if you would.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. You want me to talk about cynicism?
Demosthenes the cynic and his relation to Greek philosophy.
Yeah, well, Diogenes is my favorite cynic, actually, and he pulled quite a few stunts. Some of them were probably so indecent that I can't tell you about them on the air and remain in the good graces of David here. I think that we need constantly to challenge. I mean, even Aristotle says this, of course, and Plato's allegory of the cave, in a way, can also be interpreted cynically, and that is that whatever the received beliefs are, whatever the received wisdom is, we should remain, again, courageous enough and vital enough in our own spirits to be willing to challenge whatever it is that we're told. And this is something we should be doing more with our students, too, getting them to think and then think for themselves. So, I mean, insofar as cynicism now has come to mean something quite different, you know, it means an ironic sense of humor. But originally, it meant living very much as that previous caller characterized, I think, the Sufis and people of esoteric religious traditions, seeking spiritual and inner wisdom through partly a rejection of some of the received nonsense that they grew up with.
All right. Well, very good. The other question I would have is the great philosophical dispute, I think, for the last 2,000 years is between idealism and materialism. You know.
Yes.
So anyway, thank you very much. Very interesting.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. You want to talk about idealism and materialism?
Sure. Well, this is once again a way of talking about the mind-body problem, if you like. I mean, Plato and Buddha and the people like that. Really believe that ideas are paramount, and in essence that it is the quality of our ideas that determines our material existence, and that we must strive to understand the eternal truths and the eternal ideas in this world, which are the things of which materials are only imperfect copies. Materialists, and with the successes of science in the West, particularly since the scientific revolution and onward, there has been a great tendency to think that there is only matter in the world. And, of course, this impoverishes people. I happen to believe it impoverishes people. I like material, too, and some of the things we can do with it. But this is definitely one of the great questions of philosophy, and it's an unresolved one. And it has very obvious applications to ordinary life. Again, if people are purely materialists, they're seeking material comforts. They may then one day confront meaninglessness. They may confront problems of value they didn't even know they had. And that's because they were paying insufficient attention to the qualitative stuff. That's the stuff of mind.
Then we have another caller. This person is in Edgar County on our toll-free line. Line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
One thing that concerns me, and I definitely believe in philosophy. I don't know whether one can believe, but anyway, that's it. There's a historical factor that if you're counseling in philosophy, and giving people ideas in a paragraph of what it is that this philosophy has, then you're not dealing with the overall perspective of how this philosophy came to be in a certain historical time, whether it be back in the Greek and such as that. And in my own growing, if we want to call it that, I was raised in a, you know, Christian environment. I knew no other philosophy until I got to college. I was sent to a small private college, which happened to be, you know, a Methodist school. And we had to go to convocation, we had to take comparative religion and all of this. And the more that I saw this comparative religion, I'm thinking, they're all the same, you know, when it comes down to the essence. And so the big thing that came to me was in one of the philosophy classes, I was exposed to Will and Ariel Durant and their history of philosophy.
Mm.
And to this day, I still reread those 10 volumes.
Good for you. So do I. They're great. We call it bibliotherapy, okay? Let me so give you a different take on this. When someone's helped by an idea, very often say it's Aristotle's notion of virtue being a middle way between two extremes of vice. People have been helped. I've had clients who were helped by this idea in a given situation, and they'll say to me, well, hey, I'd like to read more about this. Where did this idea come from? Then I can say to them, okay, read the Nicomachean Ethics, this chapter or that. Then they will themselves conduct a search for more because they found something good already in this thinker. So it's really up to the client to take the initiative to want to learn more. What we do is provide a service that helps them in their immediate situation with a view to the future. But we're not interested in long-term codependent relations, nor are we really able to deliver a full-range educational service such as you've been a beneficiary of.
Right. Well, no, but that's what was concerning me. It's like you're going to a doctor and they give you a pill.
Well, I'm afraid that in our, you know, our hectic postmodern lifestyle, very often this is all we have time for. So, I mean, I don't tell my clients take two aphorisms and call me in the morning, but sometimes it almost boils down to that.
Yeah, and so, you know, that would be the one question I would have. And also, as you said in the beginning, that a lot of philosophy is very obtuse.
Yes, and this is, again, it's a private dialogue. Look, I will confess to you, sir, I also publish incomprehensible papers, okay? And sometimes you get a lot of respect from your colleagues. The more incomprehensible you are, the more, you know, they think that you're being profound. But in fact, philosophy, as you know, as it has been characterized off the top of this show, has acquired, and deservedly so, the very bad reputation of being inaccessible and irrelevant. And it's one thing to carry on a private dialogue among professionals within the academy, cloistered there often as monks. It's another thing to try to make some of the better ideas of thinkers from 2,500 years to the present intelligible to everyday people so they can actually gain some benefit from it.
Oh, I agree, definitely. Because one of the good things of my going to this small private school in, you know, undergrad was that one of my friends went on to become a philosopher and was at Northwestern University and involved in Darwinism, you know, greatly published, you know, 12 books and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read them, and I'll swear sometimes I don't know what he's talking about.
Well, the most important question is, does he know what he's talking about? And probably he does, but again, if something can be explained, my principle is this. If there's a philosophical position that's worthwhile, it ought to be one that you could also explain to your grandmother.
That's the point. That's it. Because they were the ones who were explaining to you in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left. Actually, maybe more like 7 or 8 minutes. I should introduce again our guest, Lou Marinoff. He's professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. He's also the founding president of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association and has been a philosophical counselor and consultant for the last 12 years. If you'd like to read some of his thinking, you can look for his book, The Big Questions, How Philosophy Can Change Your Life. It's published by Bloomsbury. He's also the author of an earlier book, exploring the same, similar kinds of ideas that got a lot of attention, titled Plato, Not Prozac, in which he makes the argument that philosophy is like psychology for the sane. It's now out in paper, and you might want to take a look at that. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. how, as I mentioned a little earlier, but my sort of thought was that if you ask people what their philosophy of life was, they might initially say, well, I'm not sure that I have one. But then if you engage them in some dialogue and conversation and started to draw them out, you'd find that, in fact, they do have one. And that is, they have a set of principles that they use to guide them through life. How, if people were interested in doing, in a sense, an exercise with themselves, trying to ask themselves the question, well, do I have a philosophy of life and what is it? How would people do that?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. And with the self-serving answer is that they should read in one of my books, because ultimately they're going to find a case study in there that resembles their own situation or with which they can identify to the extent that they can see how the door was open for somebody else. You know, this is why humans can serve as great examples for one another and why we also need role models in life. That is, people who have undergone similar challenges or faced similar adversities and have responded in a variety of ways are great models or exemplars. We can then look at the possibilities when we encounter a similar situation and choose for ourselves the best way of responding according to, you know, the other examples that we have learned. And again, it's no different from philosophy. Do you know that people reinvent for themselves very important fragments of Plato's system or Nietzsche's system or Jean-Paul Sartre's system, and they don't know that they've done this? But in fact, of course, they have the capacity to do it. Plato himself said that people have, in fact, wisdom inside, which needs the midwife. The Socratic method is really a kind of a midwifery to bring out into the light of day the ideas that people are harboring. So when people come and in dialogue, you can find out, as you say, fairly quickly, within a few minutes, you start engaging in dialogue, and then you find out what kind of philosophical disposition they have. And then they're often surprised to learn that they're very Nietzschean by temperament or very Platonic. And then they discover, well, gee, I thought there was something wrong with me. Now I realize I'm just a nihilist. You know, this is fine. It's a philosophical position, and it's defensible, you see? So then they identify with the school or with the system, and then they can enrich their own understanding and find out more particularly what kind of a nihilist they are. It's a journey. It's an exploration. It's a really wonderful thing.
We have a couple of other callers here. We'll try to get them in. The first one is on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question. The first comment is in regard to the statement of a previous caller or the speaker, I can't remember which, that if something is in fact worth hearing or is worth having, it's explainable to the average person. And that's a comment that I've heard in regards to science many times, that basic fundamental concepts need to be explainable to a normal human being. I shouldn't say normal, but an average human being. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. There's no evidence of that. Even in the field of logic, we've gone into symbolic logic and mathematical logic, and there's no reason to think that those things can be easily explained to the lay person. One of the things that I remember hearing on WILL on a BBC broadcast was an interview with a person who was asked to explain the recent proof that had been given of Fermi's theorem. And the interviewer said, could you explain this in simple terms that we could understand? And the interviewee said, no, which I basically thought was a great response. Some things are very, very difficult and can't be understood in any simple way. So that's the comment I want to make to the comment that things that are clearly understood can be explained to the layperson. I don't think that's true.
Okay, can I just respond to that first? You want to ask your question as well?
Yeah. Let me ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
The question is this. Some of us in science say that philosophy is a study of those that you can't, of those things that you can't say anything intelligent about. In other words, now I don't mean that as a criticism of philosophy, because that interests me greatly. But for example, how can one discuss ethics in a philosophical manner without taking into account the science of evolutionary psychology? And how can one discuss metaphysics or even epistemology without dealing with basic questions of physics? So, you know, I mean, that's very difficult, and I deal with this all the time. It's an interest of mine. And I just have you make a comment on that. Obviously, the laugh is
I think that's great. I'll answer your question first, and then I do want to give you a counterexample to your comment, okay? Evolutionary psychologists are just beginning to discover what Thomas Hobbes knew in 1651, not to put anybody down. It's always interesting to commingle and to fuse new disciplines together. No one has the slightest idea where the capacity for human ethics comes from, and there's still a huge debate on the nature versus nurture side. Other animals, you know, the great apes do in fact show that they're capable of cuckoldry and deceit and so forth, but the true beginnings of moral choice lie with human beings, and the jury's still out on whatever evolutionary purpose, if any, they serve. So, you know, there's a great debate there, but if you want to have a closer look at the original philosophies of human nature, such as put forward by Hobbes, then you'll discover that evolutionary psychology has discovered a whole raft of problems that philosophers have been grappling with for centuries. So, I mean, that's one issue, and ethics really do, I believe, need to be learned. If we fail to teach our children sound principles by which to live, they will degenerate very quickly into savages or barbarians or worse. And this has got nothing to do with genetics. What the challenge for geneticists would be to look at two samples of DNA and tell us, you know, which guy is the Quaker, which guy is the Nazi. When they can do that, then I'll be out of work. But in the meantime, they can't. And I'm free to believe that while there are definitely genetic predispositions for this or that, ethics is a matter of what we choose to do. So back to your comment, you know, I think you're partly right and partly wrong. If you look at, for example, Arnold Sommerfeld's solution of diffraction at a knife edge, then most people don't know the partial, you know, the differential equations you have to solve that problem, and it would be difficult to explain it to them. But on the other hand, look what Bertrand Russell did with the ABC of relativity. He made Einstein's special theory of relativity intelligible to a whole generation of people because he wrote a very simple and clear tract explaining how these principles worked. So I think that there is a lot of science. The most elegant and simple science, ultimately, can be explained to people, just as the most elegant and simple philosophy can be explained to them.
Well, at that, we will have to stop because we've come to the end of our time here for this part of the show. For people who would like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled The Big Questions, How Philosophy Can Change Your Life, published by Bloomsbury, by our guest, Lou Marinoff. He's professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. He's also the founding president of the American Philosophical Practitioners Association and has been a philosophical counselor and consultant for the last 12 years. Professor Marinoff, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, David. It's been a real treat. You have a great bunch of listeners out there, I must add.
Well, I think so, too.